this is something that fascinates us as a family, is the kind of frumkeit that you see happening suddenly at Pesach that's so unliberating. Kitniot is this substance of beans and legumes and lentils and rice and apparently now sunflower seeds.
Anything that swells when
rape
it cooks,
seed, anything yeah. that sunflower seeds don't swell when they cook. Do me a favour. Hello there. We're a little bit frantic this morning as Miriam's got a brand new building to find her way into. I've just managed to drop 7 kids off to camp. And of course, we're all getting ready for Pesach, which is starting imminently. And we want to wish a huge good luck to the wonderful Rabbi Robin, who is hosting a British Sign Language Shabbat next week, which we're going to tell you a little bit more about later. We are missing Robin hugely this week. She is recuperating and we're sending our love and hoping she'll be back with us soon. And we know that Robin sends her love to all of you as well. So, Miriam, how are your Pesach Seder plans coming along? Are you ready?
I mean, to be honest, I feel like I've done about a week at the gym. I wish it was because I was reaching high and cleaning the cupboards in my own kitchens. But actually, I've been unpacking boxes of siddurim and chumashim and haggadot. And it's a bit like when you move into a new house and you make the bed. I found putting the siddurim on the shelves in the new synagogue, that moment of arrival, it's very exciting. But I do feel my own Pesach planning and my own, not planning, more actually doing, is a little bit behind schedule, if I'm honest.
What's your favourite part of your new building?
The ceiling of the, what we're calling the ohel, the kind of the main hall, is completely gorgeous. There's Magen David's within it and an amazing skylight. And the ark is really just the most amazing piece of art done by a sculptor in the community who does both religious pieces. He's got a piece at St. Paul's Cathedral and kind of wonderful frivolous pieces like at Goodwood's Festival of Speed. And somehow he's brought the ark, which could just be, you know, a glorified wardrobe, into the most amazing storytelling piece. So I can't wait for the community to come in for the first time on Saturday morning and to see the new synagogue.
That sounds absolutely gorgeous. I hope I'll have a chance to see it at some point as well.
Come and visit.
It's interesting. My colleague, Rabbi Mark Goldsmith, was saying a few weeks ago, you know, at High Holy Days, we start planning months in advance. We've got a whole lay team supporting us and all these kind of, you know, various timetables and plans. And at Pesach, we're just expected to get on with it. And there's actually a huge amount to do at Pesach as well as the High Holy Days. And of course, you know, it doesn't stop with Pesach. We're then into the Omer and heading towards Shavuot. But of course, at Pesach, you're not just trying to prepare for all of the services at synagogue, the seders, the family services, the seventh day services, but you're trying to sort your own house out as well. Or in your case, I'm backing in the synagogue. See, I found myself Pesach cleaning and baking at 9, 10 o'clock at night. I managed to take the car to be cleaned yesterday. And this morning was like, no eating in the car. Put the breakfast away. But it does feel more chaotic this year than ever before.
I think it's also we're out of practice, right? Because the last 2 years have been so calm.
Yeah.
Because we've been in lockdown for them, that actually there's been an infinite amount of time to prepare. And sorry about that noise. But I think it's that thing of feeling a little bit out of practice. But I did love my late night trip to Kosher Kingdom. It does feel like a sort of foreign holiday supermarket visit where everyone's kind of in it together. There's a fervor going on. You never know which old school friends you're going to bump into. I think there's something about feeling feeling that community spirit of everybody getting ready, that there's something about being in Golders Green, filling up your trolley with matzah and other exciting, gosh, have they made this kosher for Pesach these days, items that does bring on the Pesach feel for me.
Yeah. I have to apologise for the noise going on over here. It's quietened down now. It may start again. That's our, I think it's a company that have come in to clean the synagogue ovens, and they're kind of putting the bits in their van and turning machines on right outside my window. So apologies for all the grumbling in the background.
Definitely a joy of having a brand new kitchen that's literally being unwrapped. Always good to move in, as we speak. No Pesach cleaning, just a thick layer of dust that needs to be removed rather Amazing. Than any chametz.
And have you been cooking away in your own kitchen and baking? What's your favourite thing to make for Pesach?
You're going to like just show me up as the domestic goddess. I am absolutely not. So I think the last time I baked anything, I was in the home economics room at Henrietta Barnett School, aged about 16. I'm just not the baker. I'm really good at shopping. And my sister is an amazing baker. So I get a wonderful kind of set of Tupperwares each Seder night to take home after the Seder, which are basically all our family Pesach baking recipes. So my grandma always used to make these amazing hazelnut biscuits, which my sister makes to perfection. My mum somehow used to make what we call Diwali balls. They were like desiccated coconut balls dipped in chocolate that when she was a teacher doing interfaith stuff at Akiva, she decided that actually these Diwali balls were the best Pesach recipe. So I get all the, you know, the kosher for Pesach chocolate brownies, we have them all, coconut pyramids stacked up, but really due to my sister being an absolute wonder and not because I have a single domestic goddess bone in my body. But what about you? You're the baker. Debbie, was it on a rabbiting on that you promised I could try one of your ham and tashen, and then Debbie turned up to the Assembly of Rabbis in Cantor's Kala with a little package of just out of the freezer ham and tashen that had been waiting for me. I was very, very excited. But what's your Pesach baking like?
So the ham and tashen were the cherry cheesecake ham and tashen. And last year I spent a week trying 15 different ham and tashen recipes because they all failed. They were all awful until I found this cheesecake recipe from Smitten Kitchen, which was amazing. But Pesach baking's a funny one. Like, I think it's so nostalgic. And I the smells of cinnamon and coconut and those, you know Pesach's coming when you can smell the Pesach baking in our house anyway. So although I do pride myself on enjoying the baking, I'm not sure I'm a pretty baker, but I do enjoy it. My mother-in-law is really the triumphant baker in our family, and she has tried for many years to pass the baton on of the cinnamon balls, which my mum used to make as biscuits because they never stayed as balls, and the coconut pyramids are mine. She does cinnamon balls and macaroons and plaver. And she tried a couple of times early on in our marriage to hand the baton on to me, to give me the recipes, to show me how to do it. And I have managed to hand it back mostly. So she comes to our house and cooks in our kitchen and leaves all the goodies with us, ready for Seder. For the last couple of years, I've made a Sephardi walnut cake that's quite amazing. It's got very sweet wine in it and walnuts. And I love this sort of world of discovering recipes each year. There are these Facebook groups for recipes where every year people are asking the same questions. And you think, well, we've all made Seder before, but it's so nice to discover new things that you can make.
I think there's something about how you tell the family story also through the foods that you eat. Mm. So there are all sorts of, like, there's things I only in kind of adult life found out were actually called something like Grimslich. I don't know if they're, in our family, they were known as your mother's fried things because my
they sound delicious.
Because my grandma, my dad's mum, would make them for Seder, and they were kind of like batter with dried fruit in that was fried. I mean, let's face it, anything fried with sugar on top is tasty.
It's gonna help.
but there was something about them being your mother's fried things that say something about kind of, you know, ownership of Seder and who's in charge and all of that. Clearly, that was my mum's name for them. And just that kind of thing of the family dynamics woven into who does what, who provides what. Obviously, for the last couple of years, because we've been on Zoom, we've been doing everything. And Ben suddenly said to me last night, when are we making charoset. It's my favourite thing. I love making charoset. I want to make the charoset. And I was like, oh, but we're going to Auntie Lucy's. I'm not sure who's making the charoset. We're taking the eggs, da, da, da. And he was like, no, but I want to. So we messaged my sister. We find out that Jackie, my dad's wife, is making the charoset. So he's now going over there on Friday morning to help her make the charoset so that kind of he could be part of the process. But there's just something lovely about kind of who contributes what and how it's brought to life and the assumptions of what goes in what. That is, we all make charoset, but actually there's a, well, what's your tradition? What does your charoset taste like?
Ben has just reminded me that when I was his age, I always felt it was my job to make the charoset. So my mum sensibly would try to put it in the food processor, but I wanted to make it in my great-grandmother's pestle and mortar.
Oh.
Both grandmothers on both sides of the family, I think, had somehow schlepped out of the hame these incredibly heavy brass pestle and mortars.
I mean, it would have been my first, what are you packing to take
right. thing. It's like the Kenwood of its day. It's gone in their bag. And I mean, I cannot explain how heavy these things are. And my mum has a theory that they're made from the ends of cannons, just to give you a sense of how heavy they are, from sort of, I don't know how people got hold of the ends of cannons, but that seems to be how they repurposed them. So I would sit at the kitchen table for, you know, half an hour pounding away at these apples and nuts, and mum would then stick it all in the food processor. But it's a really strong childhood memory. And then when we got married, there are these different family traditions that suddenly have to battle their way through together of, you know, well, what are we going to do? I think there were a few years at the beginning where I was making three, if not four, charosets to accommodate everyone's different approaches. Because Gary has an Iraqi charoset, which is date syrup with nuts in it, walnuts. It takes 30 seconds to make and is delicious. You know, there was the pestle and mortar charoset. I made a Spanish charoset for quite a while that was a sort of stewed compote. And then I discovered an amazing recipe from Mitchy Berger, who is the wife of Rabbi Jeff Berger. And she has combined a Turkish recipe with an Afghan recipe and created this incredible charoset that's dates and orange zest and gorgeousness.
And am I right in thinking she's actually Japanese?
She is.
So that could be an excellent addition. We're often confused, obviously, Rabbi Jeff Berger, Orthodox rabbi, and myself. We haven't got all that much in common apart from our surnames. But yes, I understand that we don't provide as good a sushi as she does.
No. And Jeff is actually very involved in lots of interfaith things. And this Pesach, of course, is the convergence of, apparently this only happens once every 30 years, according to our listener, Kevin Darville, that the calendar has met together so that Seder night, Easter weekend and Ramadan are all happening at the same time. So I know that wherever we are in all our various communities and wherever you're listening from, that we're all praying for good relationships and a positive future together, particularly at Pesach, which has been a time of, you know, difficulty and struggle through the centuries. But of course, at Pesach, we were led out of Egypt to a new life. And while our jobs are largely about leadership, we were wondering this week about who are the people that you look for inspiration from to help you think about moving yourself in some way towards liberation. Do you have people that inspire you to seek a better life, greater freedoms? Where are your inspirations coming from, Miriam?
I think I am in an incredible situation at the moment where a member of our community is the British ambassador to Ukraine. And the Pesach narrative feels so different this year with that kind of connection with the situation that's going on there. My father-in-law is one of the many people who has reached out and offered a home to Ukrainian refugees. And he is in regular contact with a family with three children who are hoping to make their way over to his home now that he is kind of primarily based in what was a sort of weekend retreat in Bournemouth. And so that real opportunity to be able to say, there is not just a room in a house, but here is a house to make your home. And that sense of kind of the frustration on both parts, or you know, on both sides of, come, it's here, it's waiting for you. And it just being this kind of slow process with paperwork for the not being here. But all of the questions around how do you leave, you know, the struggles with, you know, we don't, when we're talking Pesach, we often don't talk about the conversations around the Israelites who chose not to leave Egypt and that fear of however bad life is where you are. Like, is it easier than trying to start again in a new place where you don't speak the language, you don't know what to expect, you don't know what's waiting for you there? You know, the question, just like the pestle and mortar of what do you take with you? There's something extraordinary about being able to say, how can we understand both leaving and arrival, both being the people that were oppressed and needing and fearful, which we've been so often in our history, to being the people that can make a difference to people's arrival and homecoming and creating their new beginning? You know, I think every year this feels different. We had an interesting conversation this year while we were planning our family Seder. So I was planning it with Chessie, my niece, who's now music director at Mosaic Reform, and Ben. And we were talking about different rituals around the Seder plate. And she was saying, we need to put beetroot on the Seder plate for Ukraine. And Ben, bless him, age 10 was like, but if we've got something for Ukraine, we need to have something for Afghanistan. You know, there are we've moved on from refugee stories, but there are still Afghan refugees that have not got a home and need us to look after them as well. So we're weaving together some black, red and green sweets as a way of being able to kind of have the Afghan flag represented on the Seder plate. I love some extra things on the Seder plate to show our story continues.
So actually, one of my favourite liberation stories and inspirations is one of those extra things that we put on the Seder plate. I actually create an entire plate of alternative Seder symbols because there's so many now. And my game is that I ask our guests to guess why anything is on this alternative Seder plate while Gary and I serve dinner. It's kind of a little icebreaker game that we play. But of course, the most famous one is the orange on the Seder plate, which I grew up with. I don't know if you did, Miriam.
Mm-hmm.
So the story we were always told growing up was that someone had said to Susanna Heschel, a woman belongs on the bimah like an orange belongs on the Seder plate. So she had put an orange on her Seder plate and we all did the same and it became a regular feature. I was in my mid-20s before I discovered that's not actually the story. What happened was in the sort of late 1970s, there were radical LGB Sederim that were happening and they were creating rituals to kind of acknowledge their own experiences of struggle within the community and within the world. So they would put things like flowers in blossom to show how beautiful it is when someone can be out and fully themselves. They would put a coconut on the Seder plate as a symbol of, you know, those who are closeted and stuck inside this hard shell but are sweet and lovely inside. And one of the things that they put on their Seder plate was a slice of bread as a sign of how transgressive they felt the community made them feel. You know, we are as terrible to the Jewish community as a piece of bread on the Seder plate.
We are their chametz.
Yeah. And Susanna Heschel really wanted to honour these Siddurim and these messages and stories, but she didn't feel able to put bread on her Seder plate. So she took an orange and segmented it and handed it round to her guests and asked each of them to name a way that the Jewish community would be more fruitful if everyone was included, regardless of gender or sexuality. And what I think so fascinating about that story is that I grew up having lost the LGBT part of it. And in a way, it reinforces the whole point of why they started doing it. So I think it's really important to tell that story and how inspiring Susanna Heschel was to find a way of telling that story in her own Seder. And I love it when we find ways of bringing other narratives of liberation onto the Seder table, because it's this sense of the Exodus story and the Pesach narrative speaks to us in every generation about what is still very real today. So, you know, the sunflower or the beetroot for the Ukraine this year. But in the last few years...
It's a sunflower seed, not on a Seder table, not the same as having some breadcrumbs, Debbie. It's kidney op.
So this might be where Miriam and I differ in our approaches to Seder. We are a Sephardi household and have plenty of kitniot. But why is a sunflower seed kitniot? It doesn't make any sense.
Everything's kitniot. It's the hidden ingredients in everything. The mustard.
So this is something that fascinates us as a family, is the kind of frumkeit that you see happening suddenly at Pesach that's so unliberating. Kitniot is this substance of beans and legumes and lentils and rice and apparently now sunflower seeds.
Anything that swells when
it cooks. Rapeseed, sunflower seeds don't swell when they cook, do you?
They could be caught up with, I think it's also any seeds that could have been like caught up with the maize and caught up with the grains.
I can see how you could confuse a grain of wheat for a sunflower seed, possibly. But, you know, people who maybe really aren't that fussed about kashrut through the entire year suddenly are... Miriam traipsing around Kosher Kingdom checking every ingredient.
Also very confused because, you know, there's a whole aisle of corn crackers and I'm thinking, well, that would be useful, but hold on, they're not kosher for Pesach.
They are kitniot. Yeah. Kitniot is not unkosher for Pesach. Kitniot is something that Ashkenazim have decided shouldn't be eaten, A, because they might be mixed up with wheat, and B, because they might remind us of our pride and swelling. But actually, we become overly pious and proud in avoiding kitniot, right? It becomes this piety competition, no?
I think there's something for me. I mean, it summed up really when I spent Pesach in Israel, which is there's something about the constant reminder that it's Pesach in the particularly in the middle days when it's not Yontif.
The matzah's not enough.
There's something a bit easy, like all you're really having is just no pasta and no bread at that point. And there's something about being mindful of everything we eat in a slightly different way. I think you can get used to, you know, I'm certainly not advocating kind of kosher for Pesach toothpaste or anything like that. Anything that's like, this doesn't even fall into the same bracket. And I'm not in any way advocating for buying things with a kosher label on just so that they've got the kosher label on. For me, there's something about looking and sort of investigating and interrogating and the nostalgia that you were talking about. You know, if you grew up in a house where you didn't eat kitniot at Pesach, that is simply what Pesach is. For me, there isn't that kind of distinction of whether it's kitniot or not. It's just the things we didn't grow up eating at Pesach are still the things I don't eat at Pesach.
Yeah, there is a lot of that sense of I am continuing this line of how things are done. But actually, the way you've expressed that is how I feel about kashrut all year round, right? That mindfulness of what I'm eating is a reminder every time I eat of who I am and what my identity is and all those sorts of things. And we are what we eat, right? So that sense of negotiating food every meal is really important. So I will be probably putting a sunflower or
you
sunflower
do that.
Seeds
I'll put
onto my
beetroot. You can have your beetroot. I didn't mean to derail your story.
And of course, there are lots of other symbols that we've used over the years to talk to other campaigns and liberation theologies. The Uyghurs, for the last few years, people have added either cotton or raisins because they produce food, and also the Ramadan theme fasting. Some people have added dates. Olives for peace in the Middle East, chili peppers for climate change, and there was a Seder that added
coffee.
Yeah, coffee for fair trade or chocolate.
Or standing up for stand up and smell the coffee is a one this year for anti-Semitism.
Oh, I haven't heard that one. Yeah. I've always put coffee or chocolate for fair trade. And actually, it's always really fun to see what my guests guess is the reason these things are on the plate, because they're much more creative than you could imagine. So whatever it is that you are adding to your Seder table, we would love to hear about it. How are you making the liberation narratives of Pesach come alive at your Sedarim this year? Before we finish, we want to return to where we started. And we're really sad that Robin isn't here this week, but we do want to mention something really wonderful that's happening at Jackson's Row in Manchester at Robin's Synagogue next week. This is an accessible Shabbat morning service with British Sign Language interpreter. This is something that hasn't happened for a number of years in the UK community. And we're planning to dedicate an episode to this because there's so much to talk about. So if you or someone you know would like to join a Shabbat service with British Sign Language, it's going to be available online or in person. All you have to do is drop us a line here at Rabbiting On, and we can give you instructions on how to join. It's going to be at 10:30 on Saturday, the 23rd of April. And if you want to join the service, you can email media@rjuk.org. to let us know. And of course, as ever, let us know your thoughts, your questions, what you'd like to hear more about by getting in touch. And you can also text or WhatsApp us on 07922 575 583. If you have been enjoying Rabbiting On, do consider leaving us a rating on Apple Podcasts. From all of us here at Rabbiting On, a Chag Pesach Sameach. Everyone at the Movement for Reformed Judaism hopes that you have a meaningful and liberating Seder. And we also want to say Ramadan Mubarak and Happy Easter to any listeners or your friends and neighbours. We will be back in a couple of weeks, and we're looking forward to seeing you all then.
Chag Sameach! Rabbiting On.